If you'd like, you can go ahead and open up your Bibles to the book of Exodus, if you're not there already. Exodus, it begins by introducing us to three major characters, the Israelites, Pharaoh, and Moses. And each of these characters, they struggle with an understanding of who they are. They have this identity issue. The last time that I shared, we looked at the Israelites. And their struggle, it was with looking back and longing for the slavery of Egypt. You see it over and over in the text of wishing they were back in Egypt rather than trusting God with their future. And we saw how God mercifully helps them to see that he was with them in the past, he's with them in the present, and he will continue to be with them in the future. He was never absent, and he never will be absent, so they can continue to put their trust in him. Today, we will look at the villain of the Exodus story, Pharaoh himself, a man whose power and authority is matched only by his cruelty and evil. But, like the Israelites, Pharaoh is about to have an encounter with God, and it's one that will change all his ideas about who he is. But before we get to that, I do have something important to share with you. Barrett, who's one of the ministers here, he's out of town this weekend for his daughter's graduation. He asked me to share the following audio message from him with everyone. So we're gonna play that now.
Hey, everyone. This is Barrett. I'm down in Arkansas for Bailey's graduation this weekend. But there is something I need to share with you all. As you know, I'm something of a sports fan, but it is time that I stop living a lie. In my heart of hearts, I don't really cheer for Georgia. In fact, I think Georgia is pretty lousy. The truth is that there is only one team for me, the UK Wildcats. I hope the Cats run over Georgia this year and make them look silly. Thanks for letting me get that off my chest.
Wow, man. That's a big revelation. Now, you may find it a little bit surprising to hear Barrett say that. You've probably been under the impression that he is a huge Georgia fan. You can't ever imagine him saying something like that. Well, it's because that wasn't Barrett talking, all right? That was an AI voice generator. I took about 1 minute of Barrett's recorded voice, I input it into this generator, and now I can make him say anything I want, all right? And it is about as fun as it sounds. So here's another example.
Sometimes at night, if I have trouble sleeping, I just call up Kevin and he reads me stories until I doze off.
Pretty good. I got one more to share with you today.
I've had a lot of mentors throughout the years, but if I had to pick one person who I've learned the most from, it would have to be Jeremy Stewart. He's just so wise and intelligent. I hope I can be like him when I grow up.
That was nice, Barrett said. I think he's well on his way. Now, you know, that's pretty funny, right? And Barrett was very nice to give me permission to do this, which he did, okay. But as I've thought about this idea of identity in Exodus, I can't help but kind of wonder about this technology. And what I mean is, as it gets easier to impersonate someone, and for the record, like, this was easy to do. I didn't know how to do it, and in about 20 minutes, here we go. I have a bunch more Barrett sayings I'd be happy to share with you sometime. But as it gets easier to impersonate someone, I mean, how are we going to know who is talking to us, who we're actually hearing? We're seeing huge advancements right now in the area of AI, artificial intelligence, and I'm no expert. I don't know much about it. But for example, the art that you'll see on my slides this morning were created by AI. I typed in a prompt and it created those images for me. And by now, you've likely seen a photo or a painting, even a video that you thought was real, created by someone or recorded by somebody, but was actually just an image created by AI. And AI's popping up everywhere. You may have your order at a drive-thru taken by AI. The teachers in our schools are having to decipher, did a student write this paper or did AI write it for them? AI is inventing new medicines, it's designing parts on spaceships, it's identifying diseases in banana plants, it's planting gardens, and it's writing wedding speeches. In one strange case, this one's really fascinating. It was several years back before AI was as advanced as it is now. But there was a business, and they were using a hiring algorithm to sort through the resumes they received. So now this has become fairly standard in some fields, but what happens is that based on who works at the business and who is hired, this algorithm continually learns what things on a resume are highly valued at that company. And that way, if you get hundreds of resumes or hundreds of applications, you know, to a position, it can instantly sort through and give you the top five, top 10 resumes in the stack. Well, someone got curious about what the algorithm was actually valuing. And so they audited the algorithm, and they found it had determined two factors to be most indicative of job performance. The first factor was, is their name Jared? And the second was, did they play high school lacrosse? All right? And at that point, you really have to start asking, I mean, who's really in charge here, right? Us or the algorithm? And if you worked at that business, it was probably someone named Jared that was in charge, right? I do think it's kind of fascinating. AI is supposed to be this tool that we created and that, importantly, we control, right? That we're in charge. But already, you can see instances where the capabilities and the limitations of AI make us wonder how in control we really are. And I'm not here on some sort of like doomsday preaching mission. I don't foresee the robot uprising. It's not the Terminator or the Matrix. But the fact that movies and books exist about computers taking over, I do think it shows us that there is a real fear in humanity that one day we will create something that controls us rather than the other way around. And I get it. I mean, in fact, AI is just really the latest example of how humanity's own inventions and advancements, they shape and reorder our lives whether we want them to or not. Social media is a great example where a comment or a post can change the trajectory of someone's day or a lot of people's lives. I went to Dad, and this is a small example, but I went to Dad's Sandwiches on Tuesday, and I didn't know this. I was just going for lunch, but they had posted a new sandwich on their Instagram account that morning, and at 11, when they opened the line, because of this picture they had posted, the line was out the door. They're sold out of it by 11:30, and I was just thinking, I mean, what that means is there were people who saw this post. It changed their day, right? This picture reordered their plans for lunch that day. Or how about this? I mean, most of us carry around a device in our pocket that if it beeps or it buzzes, we have to respond, right? And we can go further back. You probably have to maintain a vehicle. You have to get a driver's license because the invention of the automobile and the infrastructure that followed it made having a car a necessity for life. Now, maybe you hear all of that and you think, I mean, no, these things don't really control me. I am in control of my life. But either way, this morning, I hope you will consider this question. Who is really in control? Because today we're going to look at someone who really wielded total control over his world. And that person is the Pharaoh of Egypt. And there's a few things that are important for us to understand about Pharaoh, Pharaoh facts, if you will. So the first is this, that Pharaoh represents rebellion against God. Now, here's what I mean. As you read, you'll probably realize that the Exodus account actually deals with multiple pharaohs, right? There's the initial pharaoh of Exodus 1. He's the one who first enslaves and oppresses the Israelites. Then he expands his plans by trying various means of killing any newborn male Israelites. That pharaoh, we're told in chapter 2, verse 23, he dies while Moses is away in the wilderness. He's followed then by another pharaoh, and it's this king of Egypt who we spend most of our time with. He's the one who squares off against Moses. He's the one that Dan read about for us in chapter 5. And while they're both distinct historical individuals, the author never names them. They're just called Pharaoh. And that's not an accident. The point isn't what's different about these two pharaohs. The point is what they have in common. And what each pharaoh in the story has in common is that they set themselves against God and his people. Pharaoh, he kind of becomes this archetype of the human rebellion that began in Genesis chapter 3. And here we are generations and generations removed from the first sin of the garden, from that desire to strike out and define good and evil on humanity's own terms rather than accept and follow God's wisdom. And we have Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, who in his own words, he does not know God and has no intention of listening to what he says. This brings us to our second Pharaoh fact, which is that Pharaoh is truly evil. Pharaoh, he consolidates the worst practices of human evil all in one person. He embodies the tragic turn the human heart can take when it sees someone else experiencing prosperity and it wants it for itself. There's really kind of two ways to see the world, right? One is you look around at the world and you believe God has made enough, that there's enough for all of us because God provides. And that means you can find ways to share and cooperate and benefit others. There will be enough at the end of the day. The other way to see the world is to look around and believe there's not enough. God will not provide. And so there must be the haves and have-nots. And so unless you hoard what's there and you get it, what you want by force or deceit or manipulation, you'll be the one to go without. So maybe that's the king of Egypt looking at his kingdom, wondering what will happen with the prosperity of the Israelites. Or maybe you're an employee. You're not sure if there's enough goodwill and credit to go around at your workplace to secure your family situation. Or maybe you're looking at your social circle, your group of friends. Does someone else need to be torn down or excluded for me to have a place here? One thing is certain, Pharaoh doesn't believe that there's enough to go around. So instead of using the authority and power he's been given for the good of all, he seeks to steal the Israelites' prosperity, building his own wealth and security and power on their backs by enslaving and oppressing them. And when oppression and slavery isn't enough, he takes it a step further with murder. Genocide. Under his orders, we're told in chapter 1, verse 22, the Egyptian people are mobilized to drown the newborn boys of the Israelites. It is the sinful human condition at its worst, a society that runs on the pain, suffering, and death of others. And Pharaoh sits at the top, directing it all. And this brings us to our final Pharaoh fact, which is this: Pharaoh is absolutely in control. At his command, people lived or died. It is no surprise that Moses was scared to go before Pharaoh. He wielded ultimate power in Egypt. The Egyptians, they had a fairly elaborate pantheon of gods that they believed in and worshipped. And guess what? One of those gods was who? Pharaoh. Pharaoh himself, he was the living incarnation of Amun-Ra, or Horus, the head Egyptian god of the sun. And the Egyptian people believed that he was eternal, he was omniscient, that he had created Egypt, he sustained it through his power. They worshipped him, and when he died, they didn't think he passed away, he simply returned to the place of the gods where he continued to rule while his newest incarnation took the throne. Now look, we still have discussions today about how much authority our leaders have in their roles. But Pharaoh, he's no governor. He's no president. He was the god of Egypt. There's no limitations, no checks and balances. He could tell someone to throw a baby into the Nile, and they would do it as they sang his praises. And it is this trait, Pharaoh's total control over his world, that is the basis for so much that happens in the book of Exodus. Because someone is coming to challenge the thing at the center of Pharaoh's life, his control. There is a fascinating interaction that highlights this in chapter 5 of Exodus. Moses, he shows up in verse 1, he says, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says, let my people go." Or maybe your translation says something like, "Thus says the Lord." Or if you go, I have an older translation, it might say, "Thus saith the Lord," right? Now, this phrase, "this is what the Lord says, thus says the Lord," is not just a statement. It was a formula, okay? This is the ancient Near Eastern idiom to indicate a proclamation delivered directly from a god. So here Moses uses this phrase because this command, "let my people go," it comes directly from God. And Pharaoh is quick to respond in verse 2. He says, "Who is Yahweh? I do not know Yahweh. I will not let them go." I mean, how dare someone presume to order me on behalf of some unknown god? I am the God of Egypt. And if you glance down to verse 10 of chapter 5, you'll see something interesting. It says, "So the taskmasters and foremen of the people went out and said to the people, thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw Go and get your straw yourselves wherever you can find it, but your work will not be reduced in the least. And you've probably caught the phrase there, thus says Pharaoh. The gauntlet has been thrown. Pharaoh is declaring himself a god. He says, I'm a god and I'm not afraid. And he steps into the ring to prove it. It is, you know, in the classic example of the unstoppable force that meets an immovable object, Pharaoh is pretty sure he's both, right? And what unfolds over the next few chapters of Exodus is a showdown where Pharaoh, who very well might be the most powerful human alive in the world at this point in history, and he is going to discover how much or how little control he really has. We get to see this showdown, this battle between Pharaoh and God, take place both externally and internally. And I want to look at each. Externally, we watch the plagues. And the plagues, they're not just punishments against Pharaoh and his people for their evil. Remember, Egypt has this elaborate pantheon of gods. Each is different. Each has their own focused domain they rule over. Hapi, for example, was the Egyptian god of the Nile, the first target of the plagues as God turns the Nile's water into blood. Now, the next plague is the plague of frogs. And would you believe this is the Egyptian goddess Heket? You see her there? You see her head? It's a what? It's a frog, right? She was a frog goddess. And as the plagues go and continue, each one matches up. Each one contests a god of Egypt. Each plague a demonstration to Pharaoh and all of Egypt who is really in control. And by the time we get to the ninth plague, God has demonstrated his power and control over all the lesser gods of Egypt. So now he moves on to the sun god, Amun-Ra. And in Egypt, what happens? The sun vanishes. Darkness spreads across the land. All of Egypt's gods vanquished. Well, all except one god. And before we look at the end of the conflict between Pharaoh and God, I want us to shift and look at the internal battle that's going on. There's this phrase you come across as you read these chapters in Exodus. It's the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. Before each plague, Pharaoh is given the opportunity to let the Israelites leave, and without fail, he refuses to do so. And we're told that it's because each time he hardens his heart, or his heart becomes hard. At least that's how the first five plagues work. And then on the sixth plague, something strange happens. Chapter 9, verse 12 says, "But the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, and he did not listen to them as the Lord had spoken to Moses." And this happens on the 6th, the 8th, the 9th, and the 10th plague. So 6 of the plagues, Pharaoh hardens his own heart, and 4 of them, God hardens his heart. So what are we to make of this? I mean, likely, as you've read the story, you've wondered at some point, and it's a very good question to ask, what's going on here, right? How is this fair? In fact, the way it's written, it almost seems certain that the author wants us to ask this question. It's unavoidable. So what is it? At some point, is Pharaoh ready to change his mind? He's ready to let them go, but God isn't finished making an example of him, so he overrides Pharaoh's will, forces him to continue to resist God? Does God demonstrate who's really in control here by literally taking away Pharaoh's ability to choose? Well, I think there are some things here in the text that give us an idea of what's going on. I don't really think that that is the case of what's happening. You know, this is one of those cases where we really feel the barrier of time and space as you read the Old Testament. You know, it's something that happened hundreds and hundreds of years ago in a place far from here to people with a wildly different culture and language. So, for example, when today we say someone has a hard heart, we know what we mean by that, right? It's negative, certainly not a compliment. It's a combination of, like, stubbornness and callousness. A hard heart is unmoved by the pain of others. It's untouched by an emotional plea. But the two primary words used to describe Pharaoh's heart here are different, and I think they're worth looking at. For one, they're Hebrew words, and also neither really mean the same thing we mean when we say hard-hearted. The first word that's used here in the text is kaved. And what the word actually means is heavy, to be heavy. Your translation may even include that, or it may have it as a footnote somewhere. And if you've ever looked into Egyptian mythology, you may know something that starts to put some of the pieces together. The Egyptians, they had this belief that your heart housed all the good and evil you'd done throughout your life. And once you died and went to the afterlife, they believe your heart was placed on the scales of judgment. On the other side was placed a feather. And if the person had lived a righteous life, their heart would be light, lighter than a feather, and they would get to go on to the heavenly realms. But if their heart was heavy, weighed down from the evil they committed in their life, it would outweigh the feather. And they would be cast off to this goddess called the Devouress, and they would be consumed and destroyed. So this term, kaved, when applied to Pharaoh in Exodus, it's a description of guilt, of the evil that weighs his heart down and makes it heavy. And you can see it really clearly in chapter 9, verse 34. It says, when Pharaoh saw that the rain and the hail and the thunder had ceased, he sinned yet again and hardened, he kaveded, he made heavy his heart, he and his servants. And you can see there the connection the text makes between sin and the heaviness of Pharaoh's heart. Now, throughout this showdown, there are times when Pharaoh kaveds his own heart. He makes his own heart guilty, heavy through his own sin and evil. And there are also times when God kaveds Pharaoh's heart, not applying sin to Pharaoh, but instead judging Pharaoh for who he is, a wicked man with a heart full of cruelty. I think that begins to give us a better picture of what's meant when we read about the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. But there's a second word that's used here almost interchangeably. It's also likely translated as hardened in your Bible, and the word is chazak. I think technically it's like chazak, it's got that hard ch on it. And this is usually a positive word, most of the places we see it used. It means to strengthen or to grow strong and firm. A good example of this word being used is in chapter 8:15. When Pharaoh saw that there was a respite, he hardened, he kazaked, he strengthened his heart and would not listen to them as the Lord had said. It's really not far removed from someone kind of hyping themselves up in front of the mirror before a big presentation. He's marshaling his determination. He's steeling his nerve. He's gathering up all his willpower. And each time Pharaoh does this, he strengthens himself. He gathers that willpower, and he channels it toward what he wants, which is the enslavement of God's people. And yes, as the story goes on, there are times when God huzzocks Pharaoh's heart. He gives Pharaoh strength. And what's incredible about this to me is that God doesn't have to take away Pharaoh's willpower and determination to win this battle. In fact, God is so big and powerful, he sees so much, he can strengthen Pharaoh. And each time, given the choice, the chance to let God's people go, Pharaoh instead turns that strength over to the heavy wickedness of his own heart, unwilling to let his slaves, his control, slip out of his hands. He says no over and over and over, all the while seemingly unconcerned about the suffering he brings on his own people. And that's how it goes, this showdown. One by one, the Egyptian gods are overthrown till even the sun god has been defeated. And Pharaoh sits in total darkness, hearing Moses' request again, let my people go. And God strengthens his heart, and Pharaoh uses that strength to turn and say to Moses, get away from me. Take care never to see my face again, for on the day you see my face, you will die. And that's what Pharaoh chooses. There's only one Egyptian god left now, and that's Pharaoh himself. And Pharaoh will learn that his control, his power, his security, it was always just an illusion. As the angel of death passes through Egypt, Pharaoh cannot even secure the life of his own son. And even then, even in that tragedy, Pharaoh never stops chasing after control. The last we see of him, he's marshaled his armies, the ultimate symbol of his power and authority. He drives them into the sea and is consumed. And that's the end of Pharaoh. I don't know what it is about jackets and coats. This is a sudden shift, I know, but jackets and coats, I don't know what it is about them that make them the worst thing you could ask a child to put on before they go out to play in the cold. But as a parent, I'm coming to understand that sometimes they are the worst thing, right? They don't want to wear the jacket. And if you've ever been around a wise and discerning parent during cool weather, you may have heard a conversation like this. It's cold outside. Put on your jacket. I don't want to. It's too cold. Put it on. I'm fine. I'll be fine. And eventually, if the conversation lasts long enough, the parent might say something like, fine, have it your way, but you're going to be cold. And I think there are some similarities between the child with the jacket and Pharaoh, both intent on controlling their own fates, only to finally get what they want, what they ask for. In fact, I don't think we're so different either. I think a lot of our lives are spent in the pursuit of control. I mean, I appreciated Matt sharing about driving. I can't relate at all. I've never done anything like that, you know what I'm saying? I think all of us try to pursue control. We cultivate, we prune our social circles. We build up wealth and backup plans. Those are just ways to control our future, right? If something goes wrong, I'm still in control. I've got enough saved to still be in control. It reminds me of Jesus' parable about the man who built more storehouses to hold his savings just to die that night. He spent his life chasing control, and then it was all gone. How about this pursuit of control? Controlling what's good and evil, what's right and wrong. I know God says this in the Bible, but it just doesn't make sense to me. I just can't agree with it. The chase for control is as old as Genesis 3. We want to find good and evil for ourselves. I mean, we know ourselves, right? We know how often we mess up and get things wrong. Yet sometimes we have the confidence to say that our ideas about morality and good and evil are the right ones, that we had the whole picture figured out and what God says is wrong. Sometimes it feels like we need someone to just grab us and say, just put on the jacket, right? Surrender your control to someone who knows better. And then the things that we can't control, what do? We worry about them. And I don't know what thing you worry about because it's out of your control. But I can tell you, man, you can drive yourself crazy worrying about where your child will go to school and how it will affect who they become. This school or this school, homeschool, are you making the right choice? I know because I've done that, right? We worry about the things outside of our control. I remember so well March 18th, 2020. It's a Wednesday night. We're gearing up for our big youth group retreat. We're just 2 days away from it, okay? And after our Wednesday night activities, I met with our team of junior and senior students. They'd been planning this thing for months and months. We put the finishing touches on everything. And then one of the students asked me, they said, hey, is there any chance that the retreat gets canceled because of this virus? And I looked at them, so confident. And I said, oh, no way. We're going. We didn't go. All right. And in the days that followed, as they stretched into weeks, I remember so vividly the feeling I had. I was upset. I was angry. I was indignant. I had all these plans for the spring and summer, and they were just ripped away. I mean, I had made those plans. I put them in the calendar, right? It wasn't fair. And as I had time to think and reflect, I asked myself, who am I angry at? Why did I ever think any of my plans are guaranteed? What foolishness to think I could make the sun rise tomorrow. James writes in chapter 4, verse 13 of his book, he says, come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we'll go into such and such a town, spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will do this and that. And that's the truth. The control is a lie. Control is an illusion. However much control you can scrape together, it can vanish just like that. It disappears. And you see it so clearly in Pharaoh's story. He fought so hard. He gave everything he had. The most powerful man in the world fought so hard to keep his control when he never really had it in the first place. And all throughout his story, you get the sense things could have been different. Go back with me to the beginning of Exodus. I do want us to notice something in Exodus chapter 1, verse 8. Exodus 1, verse 8 says, "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph." This one statement kind of sets the scene for the whole book. This new Pharaoh didn't know Joseph. And by extension, he doesn't know God. So it's really no surprise when this Pharaoh's successor responds to Moses one day by saying what? "Who is Yahweh? I do not know Yahweh." But God's ambassador, Moses, is standing right in front of him. And I think this is the true tragedy of Pharaoh, that he was so focused on being in control that he lost the opportunity to know the one who is in control. And I think that's the choice in front of us today. Will we seek to be in control, or will we seek to know the one in control? And like Pharaoh's showdown with God, I think maybe you can do an external and an internal assessment to help you answer that question. Am I seeking to control the world around me, or am I seeking to know the one who is in control? Externally, which of those two options gets more of your time and energy? Do I spend more time and effort securing and planning and backing up and exerting my influence? Or do I invest more time in getting to know my God? Do I spend my time with him in prayer? Do I hang out with his people, learning from them and investing in his church? Do I cherish his word? And internally, we can examine ourselves. Is my heart in a constant state of worry, always unsettled by things outside of my control? Or at the end of the day, though there may be things that scare me, there may be moments of difficulty, at the end of the day, do I have confidence and trust that whatever comes, God is ultimately in control? And that it's so much better for him to be in charge than for me to be in charge. And I know that because of Jesus, all things will one day be made right again, that things are going to be okay, and that he is in control. And if you haven't given him control of your life, we've seen the results of what happens when we take the reins of life for ourselves. We drive ourselves into destruction. We hurt a lot of people along the way. Not only is God the one in control, he's the only one you want in control of your life. He loves you more than anyone else ever will. You can trust him with your life. And if you'd like this morning to, talk to someone about trusting Jesus with your life, or you would like prayers or need to talk about anything else, we're here to share in that with you this morning. We're about to sing a song. You can come down as we sing, or you can catch someone after service this morning. We would love to share in that with you and be there together as a church family. Let's stand together as we sing.